Okay, we're going to call the Senate Finance meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, March 13th. Time is 9:10. Members present is Co-Chair Kelly, Senator Olson.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
And Senator Huffman, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Bishop. And Vice Chair Faircloth. So we have a full committee to conduct business today. I also want to welcome, looks like we got Senator Stedman with us again today. Welcome, Senator Stedman. And Senator Giesel. She's getting to be a regular finance member here. So.
Get her a jersey.
Very good. I think that's pretty much everybody. Today's agenda is we're going to continue, of course, with Senate Bill 21, Oil and Gas Production Tax. We're going to have a presentation of fiscal analysis on the bill by the administration, and then also Econ 1. Econ 1 will assist as well. Of course, Econ 1 is the consultant for the administration. We as well have our consultants here, Mr. Marks and Mr. Mayor. So we have a room full of consultants. But before we get started, on the members' desk is a comparison of the oil tax bills, which we talked about yesterday. You should see there's two sheets. One is a little more detailed of the side-by-side showing ACES, Senate Bill 21 as introduced, Senate Bill 21 resource, and now Senate Bill 21 finance version. So that's the more detailed. This is the more short summary. And if you don't have that, let us know. And let's see. So with that, I think we're ready to go. Mr. Pulaski and Mr. Stickle, if you would join the table, and the floor is yours. Before we get started, I just want to see any questions, concerns from committee members before we get into today's business. Senator Kelly?
That binder that you have there, do we have that, or I'm not open to that?
17.
Oh,
tab 17.
Oh, 17, got it.
16 or 17. 16 is the fiscal.
Yeah,
it should, yeah, it should be right behind this. Okay, very good. Then, Mr. Pulaski, the floor is yours, sir, or Mr. Stickle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Mike Pulaski, advisor to the Commissioner of Revenue. Dan Stickle will be walking through the fiscal presentation for you today, and I'll be available for questions and assistance. So I'd like to turn it over to Dan.
All right. For the record, my name is Dan Stickle. I'm Assistant Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue. And we have not prepared our official fiscal note for the finance CS yet, and what we're showing you here today is our draft analysis. So just before we jump into it, we reserve the right to tweak any of these numbers for the final fiscal analysis. But this first slide here is the equivalent of page 4 of the fiscal note we did for the previous version of the bill. It lists each of the 12 provisions of the legislation that could have a potential revenue impact, as well as the provisions that have an impact on the operating budget through the appropriated the appropriation for refunded credits. And what I'll do is I'll just walk through the provisions, and I'll touch on the items that are highlighted in gray are changes in the finance CS from the resources CS. So the first provision is elimination of the progressive portion of the tax. That amount is unchanged from the previous version of the bill. The second provision is the base rate. The finance CS adjusts the base rate from 35% of production tax value down to 30% of production tax value. And the increase in the base rate is actually a revenue increase to the state. And so only increasing it from 25 to 30% drops that number down a little bit. So the numbers were twice what you see there in the resources CS. The third provision is eliminating the qualified capital expenditures for the North Slope. That provision is unchanged in the finance CS. The net operating loss credit is increased in the finance CS to the 30% to match the base rate. It's also made monetizable. We don't see those net operating loss credits being taken against tax liability. We see those being for companies that do not have a tax liability. So the fiscal impact of the change to the net operating loss credit happens on the appropriation side, which is down at the bottom of the fiscal note here. And if it's okay, I'll just touch on all the operating budget impacts at once after I go through the revenue impacts. Gross revenue exclusion for certain wells. In the resources CS, the gross revenue exclusion was applied to specific PAs or units or portions of PAs. The finance CS changes the gross revenue exclusion to apply a lower exclusion of 20%, but that exclusion is applied to any well that meets certain qualifications and approval by DNR. And we've kind of, it's difficult to say exactly what the impact of that provision is going to be, so we've shown a range here. The lower amount of the range assumes that only new developments would receive the gross revenue exclusion. The higher end of the range assumes that any production in our under development and under evaluation components of our production forecast would receive that exclusion. And so the fiscal impact is, it'll probably be somewhere in the middle of those two numbers. But just to demonstrate the uncertainty around that, we've shown a range for this purpose. The extension of the small producer credit, the elimination of the provision that credits be taken over 2 years are both unchanged in the finance CS. We still don't see a revenue impact of the changes to the community revenue sharing fund. The $5 per taxable barrel credit is unchanged from the resources version, and the new corporate income tax credit for qualified oil and gas service expenditures is unchanged. A new provision, number 11, is a new provision that was added in the finance CS, which is to reduce the interest rate on late payments or assessments for most taxes that are administered by the Department of Revenue. We see that having a small impact in early years and a growing impact over time. So over the time period of the fiscal note, possibly up to $25 million per year, because what will happen is if you have an assessment that's made this year for a tax liability 10 years ago, you're going to pay 9 years at the old higher rate and then 1 year at the lower rate. And as you step out over time, the impact will grow. The extension of the exploration incentive credit is unchanged from the prior version of the bill. And so in terms of total revenue impact, in 2014 we see a $900 million to $1.1 billion impact, increasing to $1.5 to $1.9 billion in fiscal year 19 of all the revenue provisions put together. Those are offset somewhat by the impact on the appropriation side of the budget. And for this analysis, we've broken that out into the three different components. In the resources CS, we had one line for operating budget impact, and that was somewhat confusing to some folks, so we've broken it out into the three individual pieces here. The first piece is allowing credits to be taken in 1 year instead of 2 years, and we see that bringing forward $150 million in refunded North Slope credits in fiscal year 14. That's just a shift forward of that liability. That's on net, it's a revenue neutral provision. The limitation to the qualified capital expenditures credit will actually decrease refunded credits by about $150 million a year for the North Slope. So that's a benefit on the operating budget side. And then the expansion of the NOL credit from a 25% to a 30% rate under the finances CS, the net operating loss credits are still refundable by the state. And so the increase in that rate will have an impact of approximately $25 million per year, which gets you to the total fiscal impact that adds together both the revenue piece and the operating piece of $1 to $1.3 billion in fiscal year 14, increasing to $1.4 to $1.8 in fiscal year 19.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to talk a little bit about the gross revenue exclusion for wells on line 5. And you give us a range in 2014 from $0 to $50 million, correct?
Correct.
Can you tell me what production that was based on then, the $50 million was equated to?
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, the $50 million potential impact in fiscal year 14 looks at the underdevelopment and under-evaluation portion of our forecast, and then takes that number of barrels only for half of the year because the provision takes effect 1/1/14, so it's half the fiscal year, and basically says if all of those barrels receive the 20% revenue exclusion, what would the fiscal impact of that be?
Is there a way that the department could give me the number of barrels that they calculated that off of, and I'll drive home the point that I'm making? It's a valid number and a valid assumption, except that you're not including those same barrels in new dollars. Or are you?
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, the number of barrels, if I don't have it on hand here, I can certainly get that for you.
I'm just trying to see what the $50 million is looking at, and what I really want to know is then when you look at revenue impact, were those same barrels included at $80 a barrel, $100 a barrel?
Yes, Senator Fairclough, through the chair, this draft analysis is based entirely on the fall 2012 revenue forecast and all the barrels that were included in the revenue forecast.
So it's not new barrels?
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, we break our production forecast into the three components, and anything in the under development and under evaluation, that's production that's not currently producing. So it's new wells that this shows the impact of new wells that we are expecting in our production forecast, but they're not yet online.
So they'll qualify for the gross revenue exclusion if the bill were to pass?
Maybe. And that's why we gave a range. On one hand, maybe those don't qualify. That's where the zero comes from. On the other hand, maybe the argument could be made that those would qualify, and that's where the 50 comes from. So the truth is probably going to be somewhere in the middle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. These are truly staggering numbers to be looking at for this fiscal note. Over 6 years, the low end would be $7.5 billion, or an average of $1.25 billion a year. At the high end, you're looking at $9.5 billion, north of $1.5 billion a year. And everyone, I think, is well aware that this year we're not done with the budget process, but I would venture to say that we're going to, without any changes to our tax structure, we're going to have to look at the possibility of borrowing from our savings account, maybe up to $400 million. That still remains to be seen, but to move this much cash across the table is going to have, in my view, detrimental effects to the state's operating budget. So I would say that if we're going to do anything, we would have to give serious consideration to where our budget is going. You know, I know that we need to tighten that up, but there is no way that we're going to tighten it up. If we had to borrow $400 million and push across the table $1.275 billion, you know, you're talking $1.6 billion in the first year that we would have to be taking from savings. And $1.6 billion a year isn't going to keep our savings accounts healthy for very long. So we need, Mr. Chairman, I think we need to look at those numbers and how this or any other bill will meet our needs that the citizens of the state of Alaska have come to appreciate.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. And you're right. And this is the Finance Committee, and so we are concerned about the financial hit to our Treasury. But I would just remind people the reason why we have a deficit even this year is because we have no production, and the production is declining. And so, unfortunately, your fiscal notes can't show how much more production you can expect or you may speculate what will happen once we become competitive on a global basis again. And I think that's one of the problems I personally have with this fiscal note is that, you know, if we're not going to increase production, then we're wasting our time here. Mr. Pulaski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As Mr. Stickel continues through the presentation, we have included in the presentation the type of scenario analysis of new production that would be above and beyond what's projected in the forecast that we'll be able to show you for comparison.
Okay, great. Yeah, and perhaps I should hold my comments until I see the whole show. Okay, yes, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, while we're talking about revenue, and one of the questions that I have, or the loss thereof, the revenue, one of the questions I have is, you know, how many barrels of new production will it take to go ahead and make up for the loss of revenues that we're going to be anticipating here in the next 4 or 5 years, as we look at the, as the chairman pointed out, looking at the possibility of new production. And do you have those numbers, or somewhere along your presentation, do you have the numbers of, that under the new tax rate that we are going to experience, how many barrels we're going to have to make up for that loss?
Senator Olson, through the chair, we had seen previous presentations to previous versions of the bill that had a different number, but as this committee substitute has a different fiscal impact, those numbers are being worked on right now between, as I understand, both our internal team and the legislature's consultants are both looking at the issue. But
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. I'm just curious too, Mr. Pulaski, what was the fiscal note comparison with the resource bill? Or do you have that as well? Again, if it's in your presentation, I don't mean to jump the gun.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, for this presentation, we haven't laid the two fiscal analyses side by side. The finance version of the bill is a little bit larger fiscal impact under our forecast. The resources version started with an $800 to $900 million net fiscal impact in fiscal year 14, and that became an $800 to $1 billion in fiscal year 19. So it is a little bit bigger fiscal impact in the finance version.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Yeah, and I'll also add the next set of slides we have actually lays the versions of the bill next to each other. So that's a really good transition. This first slide here shows production tax revenue under ACES. SB 21 as introduced by the governor, the CS for SB 21 from the Resources Committee, and the current CS for SB 21 from the Finance Committee. What this shows is production tax revenue only. It's the major provisions of the bill, so we're not including the corporate income tax, service industry credit, the expansion of the exploration credit, or the reduction in interest rate for late payments and assessments of taxes. And also, it's a net fiscal impact, so we're actually backing out North Slope refundable credits to kind of give you an idea of what is the net impact of each of these provisions. And as you can see, at the lower price ranges, all of the versions of SB 21 give a better net fiscal impact to the state than ACES does. And then at the higher price ranges, they're all lower than ACES. Around the current price level, you can see that the fiscal impact for the finance version is a little bit bigger than 21 as introduced or the resources version. And then the following slide translates this into total general fund unrestricted revenues. You can see the blue line on the left for each of the dollar values is what we would expect for total unrestricted revenue to the state with the ACES system compared to what we would expect for each of the versions of SB 21. Again, this is assuming the fall revenue forecast and no changes in production.
Senator Bishop.
This is 2012 fall forecast, period, these projections.
Yes, Senator Bishop, these are 2012 fall forecasts, and I should clarify this is the fiscal year 15 revenue amount that we're analyzing at each of these price scenarios. So it's a one-year snapshot.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might add, Mike Pawlowski, we chose fiscal year 15 because it's the first full fiscal year where the changes would be in effect. In fiscal year 14, you have half a year of ACES and half a year of whatever proposed bills. So we thought fiscal year 15 was a more appropriate full view of what the fiscal impact would be in a fiscal year.
Thank you.
Right. And then the next batch of slides gets into some of the production scenarios. What we've done is we've put together three different scenarios that illustrate what the impact on revenue would be if new production is incented by SB 21. The first scenario is the addition of a new 50 million barrel field developed by a new producer to the state with peak production of 10,000 barrels a day and $500 million in development costs. And what we'll do is we'll just walk through a description of each of the scenarios and then show you the numbers. Scenario B is the addition of four new drilling rigs to the legacy units by the major producers, with each of those rigs drilling four wells a year and each of those wells producing 1,000 barrels a day. So each of the four rigs is adding 4,000 barrels a day of new production in each year, and we have a 15% decline rate on those. The third scenario is a little bit more robust additional production scenario. We look at the addition of one new drilling pad in one of the legacy units with a $5 billion development cost and a 15,000 barrel per day additional production rate. And then for scenario C, scenario C layers this new well pad in addition to the new field and the additional rigs that we saw in scenarios A and B. And so this chart, the black line on this chart on the right-hand side is revenue under ACES with our existing production forecast. And then each of the four colored lines are various scenarios with SB 21 passed. The first line is SB 21 with our forecast production level, and then the red, green, and purple lines are scenarios A, B, and C, respectively. And so you can see at $90 per barrel West Coast price, once you have a few years with the additional production, you actually get more revenue under SB 21 under scenario B and C, which is the new well pad and the additional drilling rigs, than you would under ACES without the additional production. And again, it's not intended to be a point forecast of what will or will not happen, but it's intended to give an idea of the magnitude of revenue change that would come from a certain amount of additional production. At $100 a barrel, the numbers change a little bit. Once you get out to the 2018-19 time frame, scenario B with the additional drilling rigs gets you an amount of revenue pretty close to what you get under ACES. And then scenario C, of course, is still providing more revenue under the new tax proposal than under ACES. Once you get up to $120 a barrel, you start to see the impact of the progressive portions of ACES. And with the scenario C additional production under 21, you get pretty close to what we'd receive under ACES, but you don't quite get back to that level. And again, this is a function of the fact that at $120, you're starting to pay a pretty high progressive surcharge under ACES. And the final slide shows at our forecast price. So in the early years, you're getting a little bit less revenue under SB 21 under all the scenarios. And then once you get out to the 17, 18, 19 timeframe, you can see that under the scenario C, you do get back to the ACES level of revenue in this illustration. And again, these are not, it's not a forecast. It's also not a best case scenario. But just to give you an idea of the amount of, this kind of helps answer the question of how much additional production would you need to get back to ACES that we've heard from a few of the members.
Great. I apologize because my question is answered here by your different scenarios, which is really all you can do is just a scenario because you don't know for sure what's going to happen and nobody does. But of the various scenarios, which one is your most likely?
Mr. Chairman, Mike Pawlowski, I think that any of these scenarios is imperfect to be sure. I think the point in scenario A is that the addition of one small field doesn't move the needle much. And that's the scenario A is just one 50 million barrel field that starts the development and declines. What you need to see is scenario B, the addition of just additional rigs that are doing more production in the legacy fields, does significantly improve the revenue picture compared to just those new fields outside the units over the time period. And that's drilling, as Mr. Stickle said, four wells a year, 4,000 barrels of incremental production, and then in this scenario analysis, we're declining each one of those wells at 15% a year. So if it comes on in FY15, the production from that well is much less by FY19. So I think if we're thinking through realistic scenarios, the addition of rigs is something that's relatively easier to do than the development of a big pad. But the development of the large pad is of course, the types of investments that the state has talked about before, and there's I think certainly potential for there. It's whether it can come on as quickly as we're running in these scenarios here. I think there's a fair question about that. It's just showing how much production and where it comes from that some of these larger developments, like we've heard about the expansion of the West Sachs or the iPads, those types of things, and can drive a lot of additional incremental production.
And I should add, one of our goals in developing these scenarios was to sit down and say, what is possible, what is plausible? And so we think these are all realistic scenarios. I'd be reluctant to put a percentage probability on any one of them, though.
Okay, and if I could, too, does this factor in the costs under ACES, like for capital credits? As we know, we're paying out a fortune on those things and not getting any production. Is that included in here somewhere under ACES?
Senator Meyer, I believe those are factored in under the ACES.
Mr. Chairman, I believe they are, and we have Matt Fonder and the team in Anchorage to assist in some of those questions, but I think it's important to note here that when ACES, the black line, is being held constant as the forecast. And so if you saw the same type of investment under ACES, you would have the same credits that exist under ACES. And we're not layering the new production into the ACES line, just so the committee is clear. We're showing what incremental production would have to happen under the CS to get towards ACES as forecast.
Very good. Additional questions? Senator Hoffman, or you just have your hand up?
Well, yes, Mr. Chairman. going back to the other table that you had in FY 2019, we're going to be pushing across the table $1.425 billion at the low end and $1.8 billion at the high end. And then you look at this chart here, 2019 at ACES and the scenario C, you know, and I think what Senator Olson was getting at is, is this going to be a good deal? And, you know, even though you're doing the numbers, it's hard to tell, but it doesn't look very promising from these two graphs. As a businessman, would you do this?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, the issue in the scenarios, and I'd like to be very careful about them, is that what it's assuming is the particular scenario and only the particular scenario is happening. It's only saying four rigs and one development. If that is all that is on the table in any meaningful change to become competitive, then you would look at this analysis as it's presented. But you can always add more and more incremental production to the conversation. And what our goal was in presenting the scenarios was to show basic scenarios of new investment that could be scaled up as the committee evaluates and listens to testimony and considers the balance that you have to weigh.
Well, I guess we can, Mr. Chairman, we can get a pretty good handle on what money is going across the table. What's going to be drilled is all hypothetical, and I think everyone knows that in this room. If there are any drills at all after the bill passes.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. I think you might have missed a few days, but we've heard testimony from industry that if we become competitive, then there will be more activity. Again, it's still theoretical, but Senator Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I think as we're discussing this, we have to keep a couple things in mind. And one is, are we here to protect the interests of government, or are we here to protect the people of Alaska? Because I've heard discussion at this table about the state savings accounts and the state's expenses. But the fact is that people who are all through the districts of Alaska, they have their own savings accounts and their own expenses. They have to have jobs. They have to be able to start businesses. They have to be able to have a future in Alaska. We are talking about keeping government money, keeping money for government, because we're worried that we won't have enough to spend on government. But the fact is, we've spent too much. Really, this comes down to too much government, not whether we have enough production or anything like that. We have too much government, and because we probably took too much money from the investors who wanted to produce an economy up here and make it a profit in the process, we have to now look at giving some of that money back so that they'll stay here and continue to invest. And as we give it back, we can't measure it against what government wants. We have to measure it against what the people want. They want jobs. They want to be able to start businesses. We have to look, after we go through this debate about oil taxes, which is essentially our revenues, our only revenues, we have to discuss our house, our problems, our spending. Because $5.7 billion operating budget is ridiculous. It is a ridiculous amount of spending. Thank God there's some savings. But those are going to be gone, not because there isn't enough production, but because we spent too much, and we're going to have to pull out of that savings to get to some point where we have enough money to fund government under a new regime. So I just wanted to make the point that as we look at this, we need to really temper our discussions as to, I mean, choose your sides. Are we here to protect government and our ability to spend at this table, or are we here to protect the people of Alaska and their ability to spend money on the things that they want because they have jobs and they have businesses well into the future?
Okay, thank you. Senator Kelly, any other questions on the presentation itself? You know, if I understand, is your consultant have a presentation as well?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Econ One has a presentation that should provide some more analysis of the gross revenue exclusion and issues that came up over the last few days in committee to provide some additional guidance to the committee as they weigh their decisions.
Okay. You're certainly going to be around so we can bring you back up, but let me, I want to make sure committee members have all asked their questions that they may want. Senator Olson, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the questions I had, and I'm asking you for direction, was as to are we going to be discussing, so far we've been looking at the revenues and the impact thereof and whatever else. I was wondering, what about the rest of the bill? Do we bring questions up on that now or the CS that just come out? And I guess my main thing has to do with revenue sharing. I've been looking at revenue sharing. I noticed there's a difference in how it's going to be appropriated, and it's just now the time to bring it up. While
I think this is a great time, Senator Wilson.
These gentlemen are here.
I think, Mr. Pulaski, is that you okay with that? Mr. Bailosh is here as well. So,
Mr. Chairman, absolutely.
Okay. Go ahead, Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look at the new CS that just come out, I noticed that the revenue sharing is now going to be appropriated from the general fund as opposed to being tied to the progressivity of the taxes. Can you explain kind of to me how that will work in the simplest terms so that the people that are out there that are being impacted by this have an understanding of what it's come from, or not so much what it's come from, what it's going to be changed to see if they're having an advantage or not, don't have an advantage?
Senator Olson, through the chair, as I understand the provision that the Senate Finance Committee inserted into the committee substitute, what it did was recognize that revenues to the state go into the general fund. The original version is introduced by the administration, softly dedicated corporate income tax revenues to the revenue sharing fund. I think the Senate Finance Committee made a decision that the corporate income tax is just revenue that comes into the state, and instead focused on the guidance in the statute itself to guide the appropriation. That the revenue sharing fund is, the legislature may appropriate either $60 million a year or up to the amount necessary to bring the balance of the fund to $180 million. It's ultimately the decision of this body to appropriate the money for that fund. But in this instance, in the Senate CS before you, it's from the broader pool of the general fund as opposed to the specific corporate income tax as it was originally introduced.
Mr. Chairman, if I could continue.
Please do.
So theoretically, as we have legislatures that change, there are new faces here at the table, new faces are going to be coming in the next election cycle, they could dramatically impact what the revenue sharing amount is going to be. Is that correct?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I would have to go back to the original language. But I believe the original language was itself a subject to appropriation, that the revenue from progressivity was up to the legislature to appropriate to the revenue sharing fund. And so this is maintaining the same guidance in terms of the amounts that need to go in. And I think there's actually some argument that the repeal in the language of the 20% limitation that existed in the progressivity feature, and instead focusing on how much the fund needs, actually provides a bit stronger guidance for fully funding, should the legislature decide to appropriate the revenue sharing fund.
And what's the potential impact that, in general, of the revenue sharing appropriation that would come out of this bill? Is it good, better, less?
Yeah, Senator Olson, like through that? The chair, I don't think we see any difference in the amount going into the fund. That's still subject to legislative appropriation, and it shouldn't change unless the legislature itself decides to do a different appropriation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. And that's our interpretation, too, is that it's the same language as that's in currently in ACES, that it does have to be subject to appropriation. Additional questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much. We can take a brief at ease while we change out presenters here. Plugged in? Okay.
Just got a few slides to go through with you here today. I want to start out with a comparison of the different ACES and the different iterations of SB 21, the investment metrics, and show you how those compare against other places in the world. This is a version of a chart that I had in my original presentation. On the left side, we've got an Alaska project, a new development, and we've got the investment metrics for under ACES and then under the different iterations of SB 21. And you can see as you go across, you know, columns 2, 3, and 4, they're up in the top left where we show the NPV. You can see that the NPV, and this is for a new participant, gets successively better as you go from SB 21 to the Senate Resources CS, which is in column 3, and then to the Senate Finance CS, which is in column 4. So each step along the way has improved the investment economics for the investor just a little bit. One of the things I'd like to point out here is that particularly at the low price level, if you look at what's happened there between column 2 and column 3, you'll see that there's quite a bit of a move up at that $80 level, and that's really due to the provision that you've put into the CS that allows losses to be monetizable early on, as opposed to being having to have them be carried forward. And what that does is it puts that new participant, their economics, really very similar to what an incumbent would have, as we'll see in the next chart. So I think on balance, that's a good move in the CS. The further down the chart, you can see information on IRR and margins and government take, and the numbers that I have arrived at down on government take comport very closely with what your own consultants have. We're getting to the same basic results. As you look across to the right side of the chart, and again going back up into the NPV section at the top, you can see that the Alaska projects will fit in very nicely competitively with projects in other parts of the world. So from the standpoint of an investor, the system should look very attractive. The next chart shows the same analysis but for an incumbent. And what you'll find here is that when you look at the finance CS in column 4, that those figures are almost identical to what we had in the earlier chart for the new participant. One thing I would like to point out, though, is unlike under ACES, where the new participant did not have as good of economics as the incumbent, under the finance CS, the incumbent and the new producer are about in the same place, and in fact the new producer is slightly better off than the incumbent. And let me just show you a little example. If you look at that $100 line there for the NPV, you'll see that under the Senate Finance CS, the incumbent has a $5.87 net present value. And if you go back and look at that comparable line from the prior chart for the new participant, you'll see it's $5.97. So pretty close, but you know, here the new participant's a little better, and that difference between the two is driven in large part by the small producer credit that is present and extended on out into 2022. I know in the past that credit was something that was considered to be important, particularly since the incumbent had the ability to write off their investments against their current tax obligation and buy down that tax obligation. With what you've done, particularly if you allow for monetization of those early investments by the new participant, that goes pretty much all the way to putting them on the same basis as the incumbent, and might be something you want to look at and think about whether or not there's still a need there for that small producer credit if you're going to monetize the losses early on.
Barry, let me follow up on that. So the need for the small producer incentive, you're saying, is not needed if you have the NOL, net operating loss?
If you have the NOL, and in addition, if you've changed the system from one where an incumbent could get an extra benefit by buying down their tax rate with the progressivity under ACES, to one where that doesn't exist. And so those two things, that change coupled with the monetization of the NOLs, I think with those two things, you've put that new participant on a level playing field with the incumbent. And then the need then to provide the additional credit, at least in my view, is not something that you may need to do. I know small producers probably would say we'd still like that. We're small. We have our economics aren't the same. But there's a lot of you've provided a lot of benefit in these other two areas.
And if I can do a quick follow up, what impact would that have to the fiscal note? Is it a wash or?
Well, as I look back at the fiscal note, it looks like it would be somewhere between $25 and $50 million a year during the fiscal note period. Now, that's just with the current set of producers. If you have more producers, if we attract more producers up here, who get into a 50-100 million barrel developments, which we'd like to have, those producers in that range would continue to qualify for that small producer credit, and so that 25 to 50 million range that you see in the fiscal note could go up if we have more companies.
Okay, thank you.
So the upshot of these two charts is that you've gone a long way in leveling the playing field between the two types of producers and providing them with a very favorable investment climate. The next issue I'd like to talk about is the GRE. And I know there's been, as I've sat and listened to the discussion.
Senator Bishop.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
No problem.
Barry, can we go back once? Oh, there you are. You haven't moved. Could you explain cash margins for me just a little bit in depth? I think I'm halfway there, but could you clear it up for me?
Cash margin is what we're measuring here is the cash flow that the producer would receive after it pays all of its taxes. And here we're looking at the first this five-year period, 2017 through 21, after the investment has been made. For the production, so this is really you're into operation. What kind of cash? Take that total cash that's generated, and divide it by the production, the number of barrels that are produced. So, for instance, if you see, at $100 a level, $100 a barrel, SB 21, the Senate Finance CS would have a margin of 44.16 in those first 5 years. Compared to what you had under ACES of just under $30 a barrel.
Mm-hmm. And $44.26 at $100 versus the Bakken at $36.48. So our cash margins are better than North Dakota under this version.
Under this version, yes. And
thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop.
North Dakota is going to be, we're going to be the envy, I think, of many places with those kind of margins.
Senator Dunleavy?
Just a quick question. I think it was back on page two. I believe you mentioned that we should have a system that's very attractive to new participants. Have any of the new players or any of the incumbents agreed that this is a very attractive, that this is very attractive to their investment plans?
I haven't heard any of the of them talk about the Senate Finance CS. I know I've heard them talk about the Resources CS. Yeah. And there, yes, I think they viewed what was happening, those changes, as being attractive. And one of the things that they were concerned about was the loss of the credits up front and the ability to monetize those NOLs. So
was that both new incumbents and newbies?
Particularly the newbies, because they were concerned with their financing up front.
Thank you.
GRE. I know there's been a lot of talk and thought about how the GRE ought to be structured and what it does, and I have some thoughts on that and some potential alternative I'd like to at least suggest that you consider. But let me first let's talk about the GRE and what it's designed to do. It's really as I was here before, talked about the different ways in which we can provide credits or incentives to in our system. One is a GRE, the other is the per barrel allowance, and then a third is, you know, sort of the capital credit that exists under ACES right now. They're all different ways of either effectively lowering the tax rate and improving the economics of the project. And to the GRE, it has the effect of reducing the tax rate. The tax rate. The question about the duration of it, I want to talk about here for a minute, and then we'll go on and talk about the mechanics of it. But I know there's been discussion about maybe limiting the time frame on the GRE, and I understand why that might be important to folks. A concern I have there is that if you limit the GRE, what you're essentially doing is increasing the tax rate on a well as it gets further into its life. And one of the things that we know happens with wells is they produce less and less over time, and the per unit cost goes up. And so if we're in a situation where we, say, allow a GRE for the first 5-10 years, whatever it is, and then we remove it, we are adding to those increased costs as the production goes on, and we will have it will tend to shorten the life of the production from a given well and the recovery, and it may also provide some incentives to abandon older wells sooner and drill new wells before it's optimal. So, and I'm going to take you through a couple of slides that suggest a different way to get there. But the upshot of it is, I think a better alternative to providing this would be to provide a lower GRE over the entire life of the well, such that it gives you the same economic value to the producer, but it won't skew the production decisions over time. And to illustrate, I've got a couple slides here I want to illustrate that with. This first one shows production from a hypothetical well, 1,500 barrels a day, beginning production, declining over time at 12% a year. The blue line shows the annual production, which you can see goes down over time. And then the green line shows the cumulative production. So by the time you get out to the end of this, the life of this well, it's produced just over 4 million barrels. If we look at what we see going on with wells that have been drilled in the last decade or so, and with this hypothetical example, about 50% of the oil that would come from this well or wells that are drilled happen in the first 5 to 7 years of the well life. And then, as I mentioned before, You know, your well productivity declines over time. A lot of your costs for operating that well are fixed, so the per barrel costs rise. And then one of the other things we know about sort of well economics is that as they get further on in life, you know, there are ways to extend the life of a well through maintenance and workovers and so forth and actually increase those production levels. So if we have a GRE that, you know, say we were to have a 20% GRE that ended in 10 years, you know, we would be raising the tax rate on that well as it is becoming less economic. And I think that's something that we probably don't want to do. It's going to have an effect that's contrary to what you're after, I think. Let me suggest a different way that you could get there. This next chart shows the economic value of a 20% GRE and a 15% GRE expressed in terms of the percentage of cost for drilling a well. So I've used this same 1,500 barrel a day well, and here I'm assuming that you're drilling a new horizontal well with an injection well alongside, total cost of about $30 million to drill this. If we were to look, and let's focus on the blue line, if we provide a 20% GRE and assume $100 a barrel on the West Coast over the life of production, what we would find is that allowing that GRE to be in place for, say, 5 years would provide a net present value benefit to the producer of 30% of the cost of drilling that well. So it's really like providing a 30% capital credit on that well production. It's the same economic value to the producer. If we set it at 10 years, that value goes up to 40%, and then you can see as you go on out to the end of the life of the field, you could go up as high as 45%. If you thought that 30% number, say, which occurs at 5 years and occurs right about halfway through the production of the well's life, if you thought that 30% was about the right kind of credit to be giving, you could get there either by doing it at, you know, with the 20% rate and limiting it to 5 years, or you could reduce the GRE to 15% and let it go for the life of the well. You get about the same economic value for the producer, and you eliminate the potential of having an earlier shut-in for that well than you would with the higher GRE and cutting it off. So I'd suggest you all consider if you think 20% with a partial life is right, I'd suggest you look at going to a lower percentage over the full life. I think it'll get you closer to the goals you're after. The next chart looks at the actual mechanics of the GRE and what's going on. And I've shown three columns here. The left is production without the GRE, and then the next two show production with a 20% GRE and then with a 15% GRE. And we walk through just the far left column. And these are the rates that are under the finance CS. But if we start with gross production of 100,000 barrels and a 12.5% royalty, we'd have 87,500 barrels of taxable barrels. If we assume a West Coast price of $110 a barrel, we'd have a wellhead value of $100. If we have $30 in lease expenditures, that would give us a taxable value of $70. So 100 wellhead minus 30 lease expenditures is $70 taxable. A total production tax value in that case of $6.125 million. Then we apply the 30% tax rate, which would give us a tax due of $1.837 million. And then we've got our $5 production allowance, which would be about $437,000. So a net tax due in that situation of $1.4 million. And then you can see the bottom two figures there show what, you know, what that translates into as a percentage of the net value of the production and then the gross value of the production. If we go over to the next column, we hold all the prices and production the same, and all we're doing here is introducing that 20% GRE. So if you look at the yellow row there, you can see that at $100 wellhead value, the 20% GRE is worth $20 a barrel. And so that gets subtracted out in the calculation of your taxable value. So instead of having a $70 taxable value, you'd have a $50 taxable value. And then your total production tax value would be 4.375, and after you go through and apply your allowance, you'd have a tax due of $875,000. And then you can contrast that with what you have in the far right. There we just vary the GRE to 15%. So at that $100 wellhead, which by the way is pretty close to where we are right now, the GRE there would be worth 15 as opposed to 20. Taxable value then is 55 as opposed to 50. And you'd ultimately get a little bit higher tax with that lower GRE.
Barry, if I may, the previous bill, the resource bill, had GRE at 30%. So that 875 that I see under 20 would be significantly less.
It would be. I'd have to go through the math and see. It also had though a 35% rate.
Correct.
For the tax rate. So those two tend to offset each other.
Yeah. And frankly, Barry, that's what we were kind of playing with by going from 35 down to 30, but then reducing the GRE from 30 to 20, thinking that may be a wash, but. It doesn't appear that it works quite that way.
It's not going to be exact, but I think you're in the right area. I do think, as I said earlier, that if you're thinking about limiting it at something like half the way through the well, I'd encourage you to drop the rate further and give it the whole life. I think it's a more efficient way to do it. But I think you are about where. That 20 and 30 combination and the 35 and 30 combination are about equivalent.
Yeah, but I guess I'm still confused though. So you're saying if you're going to limit the GRE, then you actually want to reduce it even.
If you're going to limit it and keep, if you're going to have the 20% GRE and limit the duration or the applicability. Instead, I would reduce the GRE percentage to 15 and allow the duration to be the full life.
Okay, very good. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Barry. I appreciate your slides. With the 15% GRE extended over the full life, the theory is getting every last molecule out of the reservoir. Correct?
That's correct. You want to get as much as you can. What you don't want to stand in the way of the efficient development of that reservoir. The next slide is just walking through an example here of the. I know there were some questions that came up yesterday about the NOL credit, at least as it's currently in the CS. And I have to tell you at the outset, I'm not 100% sure I understand exactly how the mechanics are to work. I think
that's great. Yeah, we thought we were the only dummies, and you get paid the big bucks, so that's great.
I think I understand the intent, and I've tried to capture here what the intent is, and I wanted to just try and illustrate it with a hypothetical development that a non-taxpaying producer would be looking at. If they were looking at developing something like that 50 million barrel field we've talked about for a total cost of about $1 billion. you'd have a capital spend, and, you know, it could look a little different than this, but it ramps up and then it falls over time. And so what you see in the far left column is your capital spending. The far right column would then be your tax loss, assuming a 30% tax rate. So column two is just 30% of column one. And you know, if you just allowed those to be monetizable at the time, well, that would be the end of it. You'd have that tax loss would be the amount you could monetize. But as I understand the intent of what's in the CS, it is to tie the amount of monetization to your continued investment. And so, for instance, that in the first year, you wouldn't be able to monetize your $7.5 million loss, but you could monetize that. You could monetize that out of your loss that you incur in the second year. So if you have a second year, you've got increased spending there in the second year, which gives you a $45 million loss. You could monetize $7.5 million of that, which is really based on your prior year's spending. And then the following, and then the rest of it, then you'd have to carry forward. The following year, then, if you spent in year three, your spending is up to $500 million with a $150 million tax loss. You could then monetize $45 million of that $150 million tax loss, which is based on your prior year spend. And then the next year, at least as I think it works, because your spending is now decreasing, you would be limited in what you could monetize. You could actually monetize all of your loss from year four, the $90 million, but you wouldn't get to monetize all of that $150 million that you had from the prior year. That would still be carried forward. And when you work down through, in the end, by the time you've finished investing in this field and your production is starting, you've been able to monetize $150 million, or half of your loss, and you're carrying forward half of it. Now, of course, the stuff you're carrying forward is getting a 15% increase, so you're being compensated in that way. But you would have to then count that carry forward amount against your tax obligation as it becomes due. So now I may not have the mechanics right, but that's 30. Right. We'll monetize 15%.
Right. It's still a liability to the state, but we're only writing half the check one way.
That's correct. We had the rest. They would have to apply against their tax obligation going forward.
I think that's what the committee's intent was. Senator Faircloth, is that correct? So the money has to be spent in the state. I'm just trying to understand the whole process. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I threw out to the committee an idea that people that wanted the state's money should invest that money in the state. And one of our contractors suggested that it be tied to capital credits as a mean to do this.
Great. Thank you.
If we go look at slide 9, this looking again at our hypothetical 50 million barrel field, on the left side, the two left panels here, I've shown the state's cash flow assuming NOLs are monetized. And the right side would show the cash flows assuming that those losses are carried forward and applied against your tax obligation. So that's the difference between the left and the right. The difference between the top and the bottom is that the top ones do not have a GRE and the bottom ones do. And I've shown the state revenues for the different categories, production tax, royalties, ad valorem, and income tax. So start just with the easy one first, the royalties and the ad valorem. Royalties are in red. You'll see those are identical on all four. They don't change. The blue, the production tax, is significantly different in the different scenarios. on the left side where we are allowing the NOLs to be monetized, you can see as the field is developed, we are sending out checks, and so the blue line is negative. But then as the field starts to produce, you see we have, you know, the blue goes positive pretty early in the field life, and we start to collect production tax revenues. On the top left, you'll see the blue bars are bigger because we don't have a GRE. On the bottom bar, the blue is smaller because we do have a GRE. If you then go to the right side, you'll see the significant difference is that where we're not allowing those NOLs to be monetized, but rather requiring them to be carried forward, we're not putting out any money up front. At the same time, though, notice that we aren't getting any production tax revenue for some time. So particularly if you have a GRE, you can see you're not going to get any production tax revenue until you get, you know, about 10 years into the project. And that's because those NOLs have been carried forward and they're being applied against the production tax obligation. So that's really the key difference between the two forms. If you allow the monetization of the NOLs, you'll be collecting taxes sooner. If you require that the NOLs be carried forward, you'll be delaying the collection of the tax. The next chart is something I think that folks have seen probably in prior years. I haven't done one like this before, but I understand that some folks find this helpful. And this is looking at the revenue share, really profit share, to different entities across the price range under the Senate Finance CS. And we're looking here at the period of the 2015 to 2019, which covers roughly the fiscal note period. The blue is the state's share of profit, and profit is measured on the left axis. The right axis is the price of oil. Green then is the industry share, and red is the federal share. So you can see that you know, as you get up into you know, a profit level here as you get over zeros, of course, industry starts to get some. The state gets some before you even get to zero in the form of royalties, then it rises as price rise. The shares there between the state and industry, roughly similar, with the federal government having the smallest share. The last thing I wanted to talk to you about was interest rates, which isn't something that I was really planning on discussing until I saw that you were going to make some changes to the way interest is done, and I think that the changes are on balance good. I know the way the current law works, the folks pay a higher of 11%, or I think it's the federal funds rate plus 5% for overdue tax. And as you can see on this chart, that 11% rate is really, you know, in today's world, it's a very high rate. And I'm sympathetic with the arguments and that I've heard from industry about not having that apply, particularly when we're in the kind of rate environment we are now. I do think that's sort of a punitive rate, and if you're going to have some sort of a penalty for delinquent taxes, it really ought to come in the form of a penalty as opposed to a punitive interest rate. I also note that if you look back just over the course of time since ANS has been produced, you can see that while interest rates have been generally declining, you know, there were periods there in the late 70s and early 80s where we had higher inflation and interest rates, even the Fed funds rate, got up above 11%. It's not unimaginable that we could be in that kind of environment at some point in the future. And so I know that one of the changes that's made is not just to reduce the rate from Fed funds plus 5 to Fed plus 3, but we would provide that it would be paid on the lower of that and 11%. And if you do that, you may find yourself in a situation like we were in the late 70s, early 80s, where market rates are actually higher than 11%. So I guess I would encourage you to maybe think about just eliminating that 11% number altogether and tie your interest rates to, you know, I think the Fed plus 3 is a good number. I've shown some other numbers here, a AAA bond yield and a BAA bond yield, and you can see that Fed plus 3 over time has fallen right in between those two numbers. So, you know, your AAA over time has been about 8%, your BAA a little over 9%, and Fed plus 3 would put you right in between those two. And so I think one way you could simplify your system and make it, you know, equitable for both sides is to just have the Fed plus 3 and eliminate the 11% altogether. And that's all I have for today.
Okay, great. Good presentation, Barry. You cleared up some things. I do like what your suggestion here on the interest rates, rather than trying to find the right number, which we know is going to change, just do what your suggestion here, Fed plus 3. Senator Bishop, question? Oh, okay. Senator Dunleavy? No. Senator Hoffman? Question? Okay. All right. I think we're good for now, unless there are any questions from committee members. We have a floor session at 11. Thank you, Barry. We have a floor session at 11. We'll come back at 1:30. We'll have perhaps we can have all three consultants here at 1:30 in case there are any additional questions. I don't know if anyone has signed up to testify from the industry this afternoon, but we'll have an open mic for them this afternoon. And then I think we're just about done. So with that, we will stand adjourned till 1:30.